Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has just published her fourth novel, Happiness. She's won many awards for her previous books, The Hired Man, The Memory of Love and Ancestor Stones, as well as her memoir, The Devil That Danced on the Water. Not only an award winner, she's judged some of the most prestigious prizes. She's an academic too, and she's been awarded an OBE. Aminata Fauna, welcome.
Thank you.
Firstly, congratulations. Happiness has been receiving amazing reviews. It is an extraordinary book. It has resilience, I guess, at its core. And so I wondered if we could start by talking about your own resilience and the events of your childhood, which you covered in your memoir. Your mother from Scotland, your father from Sierra Leone.
Yes, my mother from Scotland, my father from Sierra Leone, met in the early 1960s or late 1950s in Scotland, where my father was a medical student, had three children, of which I was the last, went to Sierra Leone. I was only 6 months old, so I didn't really know Scotland at that time. Went to Sierra Leone at a time of great change in that country. Independence had been achieved, and the country was on a path towards a one-party dictatorship, as many of the African countries followed that trajectory. My father became a political activist. He was always highly political. He became involved in politics, something that was going to continue for the rest of his life. But he wasn't always on the side of good fortune. The very party that he supported and ran for as an MP itself was led by a man who began to move the country to a one-party state, the very issue on which they'd fought the election. So my father resigned in protest and set up an opposition party, which was outlawed overnight. And one thing led to another. He became the main opposition to the government. He became very much public enemy number one. And over time, he was arrested and rearrested, and ultimately he was executed.
And this is something that you write about in your memoir. We'll come to that in a moment. You were then growing up between these two worlds. Here was Scotland, Sierra Leone, this appalling tragedy set right in the middle of it. Where were you in between all of that? Did you feel a sense of kind of split identity?
No, I didn't. I think it's a fantasy imposed on people by those who have never negotiated more than one way of being. I'm asked this question over and over: how does it affect you having two different cultures? And I always want to say, how does it affect you only having one? Mm. You know, we can't know each other's experience. But over the years, I've realised that the interest, and sometimes almost invasive interest in people who have more than one culture, is actually, the source of it is the anxiety of the speaker, of the questioner. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've come to realise. So those of us who come from more than one culture and negotiate all the time come quite quickly to the realisation that there's more than one way of doing things and there's more than one way of seeing things. People who only come from one culture are quite threatened by that idea. I mean, I'm not saying all people, but a good many. And that's how cultural monoliths are built, on the idea that there is one way of doing things, there is a tradition, we stick to certain rules, and in that way we will find comfort, contentment, safety and security. So people like you and me become an affront to that. It's how can you move between these two worlds? How can you negotiate them? And also, I think the questioners also have to hope that in some way this isn't working out, because what they've inherited is this idea that there is only one way of seeing, doing and understanding the world.
For those of us, though, who do move between the two, quite often there's this sense of loss, that you can't be completely in the moment in one or the other. And you've got a fantastic line in your latest book, In Happiness, for all of us who have lost something: what is nostalgia but loss dressed in finery? I think that's a fantastic
Although,
line.
In fact, I'm talking about the English in that line. So I'm not talking about people with more than one culture. I'm talking about the past, that for the British, the past, the glory years, have created this kind of sense of loss. I think loss is something that all of us go through life carrying, because life never stays the same. And we look back on certain periods, whether we do that as individuals, whether we do that as countries and cultures. And I think Britain in particular has this extraordinary sense of loss around it because of the loss of empire. Mm. I mean, you only have to go out of Britain for a few months or a couple of years and realise that this is a country which looks almost exclusively to the past. Mm. It's in the television programmes, it's in the literature, it's in the politics, it's in so much. And it's a devastating sense of loss for people, I think, on an individual as well as a national level.
So did Brexit happen because we love Evelyn Waugh?
Yes, I think that's not entirely misplaced, actually. I think there was a sense underlying some political decision-making and maybe some self-interest. And I'm a Remainer. I have no problem saying that. I think people who voted Leave, yes, some did vote on a political decision. Some voted because they thought their lives would become better. But I think underpinning all of that was this sense of Britain that somehow what we had lost would be regained, which was Britain as this unique and special place that Britain had in the world for 100-odd years would somehow be regained, and we wouldn't be subsumed, as people feel like we're being, into a broader culture, the EU.
Of course, you were educated here. You went to boarding school in Britain, and then you went to University College London and studied law. Was that a natural progression on from school? Did you feel at that point you might be a writer?
I wanted to be a writer, and I had a careers mistress. I went to boarding school from 6 to 18, so I was incarcerated for a very long time. But I went to a girls' boarding school, and oddly, it was a very good school. I mean, I say oddly in terms of what I'm going to tell you in a moment. It was founded by suffragists. We used to have the list of firsts read out every year, start of the school year, and it was the first woman who had to have gone to our school to achieve certain things. We had the first airline pilot, we had the first woman judge. So the school was extremely progressive in many ways. However, my careers mistress didn't seem to be entirely like that. And I remember when the sixth form, when I told her that I wanted to be a writer, she suggested that because I was studying French and Spanish, I might like to be a translator. And so I said, well, actually, I was thinking that I would write the things that were translated. And she looked at me and said, I have never heard such arrogance in all my life.
And now you've translated into what, 18 languages?
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic.
And I know and respect my translators hugely. It's a very difficult job. But at the same time, I did have... I mean, she warned me how I'd never make a living in other things. But I did. You know, I came from the kind of West African family, and a lot of listeners from India, Pakistan and any African country will recognise this. There were two choices. It was lawyer or doctor. Mm. That's how my father saw things, right? You had to have a profession, choose which one. I mean, I suppose engineer and things like that could have come into it, but that's basically how it was seen in our family. Mm. And so by default, I chose law. I think my family would have collectively fallen off their chairs if I'd said I was going to study something like English literature. I think they would have thought it was very insubstantial. Mm.
But in fact, you ended up at the BBC for 10 years.
I did. Rapidly, I realised I was never going to become a lawyer. I did my law degree and I got a decent enough degree. And then I left. Yes, I became a journalist. I joined the BBC. This was all a way of moving towards writing, you see. In my mind, I thought, well, I'll become a journalist. I was very lucky, actually, that when I was at university, I shared an apartment with the daughter of two very well-known British journalists, Polly Toynbee and Peter Jenkins. So I was very influenced by them, their lives, their views, their way of being in the world, which was just wonderful. And they were extremely kind to me. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I did do it. I was a BBC current affairs and arts reporter for 10 years. Mm. But it wasn't ultimately the way I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to tell stories with much greater complexity and also with a different worldview. The BBC is a fantastic organisation, but it is absolutely British. Mm. And I felt that I was telling stories to Middle England, in the language of Middle England, from a viewpoint of Middle England.
Yeah. So you then went on to write your memoir in 2002, and I wonder if that decision to tell a very private story, for that trauma to precede you wherever you go, but not define you, has been something that you've ever been uneasy about.
Well, at the time, the imperative was so great. Don't forget, Sierra Leone was still locked in civil war. The memoir was published in 2002, which was the official end of the war. So I started writing it, you know, a couple of years before that, 1999, and I went back to Sierra Leone to witness the end of the war. And it was so evident to us, to everybody who'd known the trajectory of the country that we were really the first casualty of a process that had brought us to war. And something else had happened, which was that my father had left a letter that he'd written the day he was due to die. He had written it and he had given it to a man who had, a journalist who'd come to talk to all the condemned men, sent actually by the government and a journalist for one of the state-run newspapers, as they all were by that time. But unbeknownst to the government, had been a one-time supporter of my father. So my father had written this letter and given it to him, and originally he'd been given the pen and paper to plead for his life. He didn't do that. He wrote a letter to The Nation, and he gave it to this journalist who hid it for 25 years because there was nothing else he could do with it. Wow. He couldn't publish it. There was nothing else he could do with it. His widow found it at the end of the war and published it. I was actually already underway with my memoir then. There came this letter which absolutely predicted the whole trajectory of the country and said, we will see the end of the rule of law, and once we see that, we will go to war. So the imperative to tell that story was huge. My family was absolutely behind me in doing so. You know, it had to be told then. Our story was really the vehicle to tell it through. But I did know that once I'd written a memoir, you know, that was it. It was out there. And not long ago, I wrote an essay called The Aftermath of Memoir, talking about the fact that you can't get away from it. All the other people I've known who've written memoirs and how they feel about it. My sense is that if you have a compelling reason to tell that story, which goes beyond the self, then it is something I can live with. There are repercussions. Mm. I mean, repercussions, no, but there are echoes. They are always felt. And in a way, you are constantly framed by that. Mm. And I sometimes wonder when I go somewhere, when somebody's coming to a dinner or something, the host might turn round to you and say, oh, that's so-and-so, and she or he such-and-such, right?
Yeah.
When someone does that to me, I think, is that how you introduce me? Mm. That's Aminata Fauna. She wrote a book about her father's execution. Yeah.
Yeah. I usually say, that's Aminata Fauna. She's got the most gorgeous gold dress.
I do.
You then turn to fiction, Ancestor Stones, and then followed by The Memory of Love. Of course, the war in Sierra Leone, very much at the heart of that, the war in the 90s. Lots of research. You went to hospitals and watched amputations.
I love all that stuff. There's just no doubt about it. I mean, you know, of course, my father was a doctor first. So when I was in the operating theatre, by which time I'd sort of managed to inveigle myself in, certainly on a daily basis. And one of the surgeons turned around to me and he said, you know, you have got the strongest stomach I have ever seen in someone who's not a doctor. And then I said, well, my father was a doctor. And not that I watched operations when I was 10, but, you know, I came from a medical family and we were around that idea. The human body was this functioning machine and that I had no automatic fear or revulsion associated with it. But I have sometimes, when I was doing readings, been describing my research and watched somebody in the audience just turn green. And I've had to say, I'm sorry, you know, you're having trouble with this. And they're just like, yeah, I'm on the point of fainting. I don't want to hear any more about it. But for me, as a writer, research informs the character. What I do is I walk the walk with my characters and try to figure out, if this is how they live, how does it affect their other decision-making, their other ways of being? What, in fact, qualities would they have that would have enabled them to do this job in the first place? So if you take a character like Duro in The Hired Man, who was a hunter turned sniper, and a very, very good sniper, I learned to shoot a high-velocity rifle for him. There's no way he would have remained the character that I sort of vaguely drummed up in my head if I hadn't done that. Mm. So he changed. He couldn't remain the same character I'd vaguely drummed up in my head. I realised that he was a man of such calm temperament. To be that sort of person, you have to have utter self-control.
And that book, of course, set against the backdrop of conflict in the Balkans. And I wonder if you see big similarities between those two conflicts, what was going on in Sierra Leone and what was happening there.
People were very surprised, in a way they probably shouldn't have been, that I'd written about Croatia, because we do like to lay assumptions on writers of certain kinds. But these were two contemporaneous wars. They were going on at the same time. They were reported completely differently. So the Sierra Leonean conflict was reported pretty much as, certainly in the Western media that I saw, pretty much as, here goes Africa again. They're chopping each other up again. Whereas the Yugoslav civil conflict was reported with every nuance of the politics. Mm. You got to know who the Chetniks were, who the Bosnian Serbs were, what the Croatians were doing and all. Every single faction was identified. I remember finding it very, very complicated when I was reading it in the newspapers because I was reasonably young, trying to follow it all. And then you look at the coverage of an African war and it's completely different. And yet there was my father who'd predicted it 25 years ago. Mm. And actually, the big difference between Sierra Leone and Croatia was ours wasn't ethnic. Contrary to every expectation, the African one wasn't ethnic and the European one was. But there were very many similarities. Both countries, geographically, coastal, rural economy, same size population. Both have endured 25 years of dictatorship, followed by an economic turndown. So all of these things, these were parallels, albeit that one was in Africa and one was in Europe. These were absolute parallels that took the countries on exactly the same trajectory towards civil conflict. You need two more after that. You need the rise of a charismatic psychopath. We got Fode Sanko. But somebody who is going to focus and harness that anger and turn it into something violent. And you also need access to weaponry. One of the things I thought very early on was, gosh, that really moved fast in the former Yugoslavia. Was it in Sierra Leone? It seemed to be such a slow burn. And what I discovered, quite by happenstance actually, because I was talking to a friend of mine who'd reported both conflicts, but he was talking about the former Yugoslavia. And he said, well, the reason that took off so fast was because it was a country of hunters and every man had a rifle. And Sierra Leone, of course, is a country of farmers. But if you look at the tools of each war, Sierra Leone, it was machetes, they hacked off people's hands, that became the emblematic atrocity. And the former Yugoslavia becomes a sniper's war. And of course, in the former Yugoslavia, unlike Sierra Leone, they had a standing army, they had national service. So they actually had, you know, every man was a trained fighter, which was completely different from us. So the wars took a different trajectory in that sense. But I found all that completely fascinating. But that is why Duro was a rural farmer hunter and he became a sniper.
And you get right into his head. I mean, I find it quite extraordinary the way you seem to, with such ease, write as a man.
I don't think they're very different, I suppose that's why. I don't actually sit there and think I'm going to write a man. I know that he is a man, but I don't think, oh, what would a man do? I think, what would somebody with this set of choices do? Mm. So one of the things that, you know, I sometimes think, what you really notice when you start writing male characters is they have, number one, a great many more choices. And number two, you don't have to worry about their safety all the time. I always say you don't have to get them home safely at the end of the chapter. But they have a lot more freedom, which is why it can be tempting to write as a man. Whereas writing as a woman, you've got to think your way harder around certain obstacles that she's going to face in her life that a man isn't going to face. So I just tend to think, if I'd grown up in this way, in this landscape, for example, I really think landscape informs people's choices and patterns of thinking. If I'd grown up this way, in this landscape, at this time with these choices, how would I negotiate this particular moment? Mm. And that's how I approach whoever I'm writing, really. I think skin colour and gender are distractions, really, in thinking about character.
And you need to understand human nature. And I noticed that, in fact, psychiatrists feature large. I mean, you have
yes,
two.
Yes, I like them.
You use them a lot. Is that something that you think you might have done? That you, I mean, or I suppose you use it in your work now, anyway.
Yes. I often write people with careers I would have liked to do at some point. I'm fascinated by psychiatry and psychology, the work of those professionals. I think partly because it is all about how people think. So that's what writers do. And writers are, in a way, our psychologists. That's what we do. We figure out how people think and why they think the way they think. And the other thing that interests me so much about psychology is it's a self-interrogating profession. There are lots of critics of psychology within the world of psychology, who feel that certain ideas have been taken too far or other ideas no longer have currency. And one of them, of course, which I've written about a lot, is there's a great debate around trauma. First of all, that it wasn't recognised, that PTSD was not recognised. Men used to be shot for deserting their posts in the First World War. there was a thing called shell shock, which nobody really understood, but began to be recognised. Then over time, we get to the recognition of post-traumatic stress disorder, that extremely violent events can affect your mental health in severe ways. Now we're actually at the other end of the arc, which is people saying, well, hang on a minute, now we're calling everything traumatic. We're labelling life events that we can expect to happen. The loss of a job, a divorce, the loss of a partner. We're now labelling these traumatic events and insisting that the emotions that they produce are things that could be treatable, that you need to see a therapist or you need to go on medication. And I find that debate fascinating. I do think that we overuse the term trauma, but I mean that more popularly. People will often describe an incident as traumatising. And I'll say, well, when I listen to it, I think probably upsetting or it could have made you angry, but I doubt very much it was genuinely traumatising in a medical sense. But even within the profession, you know, this debate is going on of people wishing to extend the definition of trauma and other people saying, no, this has now gone too far. We need to haul it back in and say we're actually talking about people who've been through certain kinds of extremely violent events, but not simply medicalise and pathologise every single life experience.
Which, of course, is at the core of this book. Also, going through this book, the wonderful animals. You have coyotes, you have foxes. The idea that wild animals in an urban space, how they adapt, relates to, I suppose, the whole theme of resilience within the book.
It does. I really wanted to write about the animals because I wanted to write about a city. And I wanted to write about how did this African psychiatrist, Attila, who comes to London to deliver a keynote speech on trauma. And I sort of thought about where to send him. I want him to go to the Western world. We were going to look at the Western world through his eyes. We were going to reverse the gaze. And instead of looking Africa through Western eyes, which is what has been done, you know, ever since the days of Heart of Darkness, in a particular way and relentlessly and never flatteringly, how would he see a Western country? I decided on London because I know it so well, and also because there would be the colonial connection between London and where he comes from, Ghana, both in terms of his studies, but also in the historical trajectory, language. It would make sense for him to come to London. I chose a city because in a city, so much of it lives side by side in terms of populations. The wealthiest and the poorest live side by side. The most powerful and those without rights, people who are undocumented, live side by side. But also people with restricted rights or fewer rights. I'm not just talking about refugees and immigrants, but elderly people and children who feature in the book. And also this world of urban wildlife. And what I found fascinating about urban wildlife is, number one, that it exists, that it is so prevalent, that there are foxes and parakeets and peregrine falcons and all kinds of creatures making their lives in our cities. But also the extraordinary division that these creatures produce. Some people, like me, are fine about them, actually quite like them. I mean, I fox cubs in my garden. I find them very appealing. For other people, they produce the most visceral rage. And you have to wonder, really, the rage corresponds with nothing the animal or animals could really have done, no crime they could have committed. And you have to wonder what that rage is about, really.
It is extraordinary. And the way that you take us through this journey and show us all of the hidden things, including the hidden people, as you say, children and the elderly, but also the security guards, the man painted silver and being a statue, the traffic wardens, all of these people show us a completely different side of the world, really.
I wanted to sort of flip the process and instead of looking at what was obvious and in front of you, look at what was smaller and hidden. And I think in a way, that's sort of how I go through cities. I'm not terribly interested in museums and art galleries, to be honest. I'm actually much more, and many people are, much more interested in the smaller details of the city, in finding those places and things that are less obvious.
I think that the writing of a love story with, because that's really what it is, I suppose, too, with these two mature, damaged people as the protagonists.
I don't think they're damaged.
Well, they have every potential to be damaged. And I suppose that that's the thing, is that they have come through that.
They have lived lives.
Yeah.
I don't see them as at all damaged. They have lived lives and they enjoy a full range of emotions. You know, so Attila is still grieving, and he knows he's still grieving, Jean gets frustrated by public attitude to wildlife. She's a little bit distanced from her son, something that she regrets and can't quite fix. But I don't see them as damaged, actually. I just see them as pretty much fully integrated adult human beings. Mm. And in the way that the animal population demonstrates that actually the more adversity the animals in the book face, the more people try to eradicate them, eradicate the coyotes and the foxes and the parakeets, the more the animals develop resilience and the more they grow, the more they resist, the more they survive. So with my human characters, I thought, well, here's a sort of rather interesting allegory, you know, what happens to them? And I think that what we're looking for when we think about happiness is a kind of innocence that we enjoy in childhood, which allows us to be happy. So when people think back to when were you most happy, they tend to think of childhood. But that is innocence, and it's not the same thing. And so we tend to think of all the things that happen in our lives, like Jean getting divorced, getting a little bit distance from your son, leaving your country, having a couple of disappointing love affairs, or Attila losing his wife. We think of all these things as ruining that innocence and therefore damaging us, as though adversity necessarily damages. What I'm saying is it doesn't necessarily damage, but you're never going back to what you were before. You're never going to go back to that state of childhood innocence and that kind of pretty much uncontrolled glee that we see children enjoying. I mean, you're never going to get back to that without the help of chemicals. So I see Jean and Attila actually as simply being, you know, fully realised human beings who have all of these things. They have a past, they've endured adversity, they have a full range of emotions, but that doesn't mean that they are either damaged or not happy.
And this book really explores that and gives us so many stories on so many levels. I would urge everyone to read it, to achieve happiness by reading Happiness, which is published by Bloomsbury. I'm Anata Fauna. Thank you so much for talking to me. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.